I feel that I'm in trouble already because the theme of my address today is being a mystic. And the being bit was left out and the notice outside the church. The church has that rather cryptic title, A Mystic. I feel the being is very important, so please add the being a mystic when you think about the title of my service today. Now, I do understand that if one talks about mysticism or mystical experiences or anything that slightly has a dodgy overtone to it, many good Unitarians come out in a rash and feel compelled to lie down until this topic goes away. I would ask that you listen to me. I think the topic of mysticism is worth looking at for a number of reasons. But bear in mind the man with his ox. I'm not asking you to believe anything mad or crazy. And I'm certainly not saying to cast aside what modern science teaches or advocates. Science isn't perfect, but that's no reason to just leave it in the umbrella stand at the entrance to the church to pick up as you're on your way out. Keep the science. There are a number of reasons to look at mysticism more deeply or more systematically. The first one to my mind is that it's my contention that mysticism is something that we all do. We're all mystics at heart. I mean, being a mystic is something that comes naturally to all of us because this is the way our brains are wired. The ability to have mystical experiences hardwired into our neural networks. We can't not be mystics. We can ignore it and we need not be mystics, but it's not something that we have to choose necessarily very hard to be. Mysticism is an innate function of the human brain. The other thing that's interesting about, mysticism is that there's an awful lot of it about. It seems to be everywhere and across time and continents. The Oracle at Delphi is recorded in several of the ancient Greek texts. The priestess to the god had visions and shared her wisdom with unlikely visitors of all shades. All peoples seem to record mystical experiences from people like Luria and Cordovera, the mystics of the Kabbalah who set up their school at Safed in Galilee sometime in the 1560s. Two, the ones we have heard of, St. Anthony in the early days of Christianity, who lived in the Egyptian desert. I'd recommend that you don't bother reading him. I mean, I had to go with reading his life story a couple of years ago, and it was utterly depressing. If you want to be depressed or feel that Christianity is questionable, I think read what he has to say. He had a miserable time of it. He went out into the desert to get close to God, and all these demons followed him out, and he was constantly persecuted, and I feel he wasn't a good advertisement for mysticism, but read what the Desert Fathers yourself, and don't feel you have to take my word for it. You have to take my word for nothing, but check this out. Then there are modern days mystics. People like Mirabai Starr, Wayne Teasdale, Ilya Delia. Perhaps the two Irish ones that would come to mind are Sister Stan and John Feehan. There's a wide range of mysticism and mystics to read from. If you want somebody who is on a particular Christian form of mysticism, Thomas Kennedy, who died recently, or Richard Rohr, all well worth reading. So now that I have given you out your homework for the next 6 months, I'll tell you more about what I think about mysticism. There are several ways of studying mysticism, but the big problem is always, how do you define mysticism or mystic experiences? There isn't one clear, precise, mantra-like definition. But the one I go back to is, I think of mysticism or mystical experiences as something that happens inside the individual. It's something that could happen to me when I'm meditating, when I'm walking down the street, when I'm doing something else and it interrupts my constant stream of background chat. Jess Hollenbach, who has written a fabulous tome about mysticism, if anyone is really dedicated to reading it, says that all of us go around constantly talking to ourselves. And if we can cut that out, we free our brains from mystical experiences. A mystical experience is different from magic in that a mystical experience is something that happens inside myself, inside yourself, inside the person who's reporting the event. And it's different from magic in that it affects me or you or him or her only, whereas magic affects the rest of the world. Magic is like Jesus converting the water into wine. That's something that everyone else could tell about, whereas St. Paul's famous mystical event on the road to Damascus, he saw a bright light and he heard Jesus speak to him. But if you were coming down the road on your donkey behind him, you would just have seen him fall off his horse. You wouldn't have seen the light and you wouldn't have heard the sound. This happened inside his head. Even though it had massive transformative effects on him, there was nothing to record on your smartphone if you were lucky enough to be there with it on that day. There are two ways that mysticism is studied academically, at least in the modern world. One of these is carried out by the theological school at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. What they have done is they have collected up a lot of the texts, the accounts of mystical experiences from all over the place, but mostly Europe in the Middle Ages. So they have the texts of mystics like Teresa of Avila, Marjorie of Kemp, St. John of God, and also the Kabbalah scholars. And they look at what these texts have in common and how they differ. According to Hollenbach, there are seven general characteristics of mystical experiences. I would love to tell you all about them, but we'd be here until 4 o'clock if I was to go through all of this. So I think if you're interested, follow up afterwards. I'll focus on just two. The first one is that somebody having a mystical experience is awake. It doesn't happen when you're asleep. And it doesn't happen when you're in a drug-induced coma. The people reporting mystical experiences are awake and they're aware of what's going on. The second is that mystical experiences are often somewhat amorphous. They're open to interpretation. And how people interpret a mystical experience depends on their cultural background and their faith background. So that when something happens and somebody sees a bright light and a figure conveys a message to them, when it happens at Knock, it's the Blessed Virgin. When it happens maybe to a shamanic priest in Alaska, they have a different way of fitting it into their background. It's like, in the 1970s, two Californian psychologists, John Grinder and Richard Bandler, published a book called The Structure of Magic. This book set out how our thinking and behavior has a pattern to it, and we tend to repeat the pattern again and again, and that if we can break the code of how we're behaving or what we're thinking, we can change how we act in the world and how we think. This is the same. I think the same thing is true of mysticism. Mystical experiences have a pattern. There's a way of doing mysticism that follows on. To give you an example, If I said to you, now my mystical experiences are usually not do not usually involve visions and bright lights, but so this is a fictional story I'm telling you now. If I said to you that I was awake during the night and I was very disturbed when the garlic protecting the window rolled off the windowsill onto the floor, and I got up and I was searching frantically for the bottle of Lourdes water when I fell through the wardrobe into Narnia, you're immediately going to be slightly suspicious of this because I have mixed up too many tales. We have Dracula, we've started with Dracula. We have gone on to A Pilgrimage to Lourdes and then on to the works of C.S. Lewis. So this immediately you're saying, nah, this doesn't fit the pattern. And you just know it doesn't fit the pattern. So you're suspicious and you say, absolutely did not happen. On the other hand, if I say that when I was coming to church, I got off the bus over by Loretto on the Green and I was walking along the top of Stephen's Green, coming up on University Chapel, when I met John Henry Newman. Now, this is something you could believe because John Henry Newman possibly was around here, so it's possible that I would have met him, and this is fits in. And if he said to me, hold on, hold on, I have a message for you. And I said, yeah, look, sorry, man, I'm in a hurry. I'm not dealing with this today. And I go to step around him, and he puts his hand up and hold it, stand there. And I'm frozen to the ground. And he said, I have a message to you from God. And I sort of sigh and say, oh, go on, so tell me what God wants. And he tells me three things. Now, it's quite easy to invent what would be likely to be three messages in this because we all know the format of visions. It would, if I started off by saying, you need to say 10,000 Hail Marys for the conversion of Russia. And you start to say, oh, caught. This is the sort of thing that you'd expect having known about the apparitions of Our Lady at Fatima and at Lourdes and at Knock. This is something that fits in with the pattern. And then he could say something like, oh, do you remember the story in the gospel where Jesus curses the fig tree as a reminder of what happens to people who don't live up to God's expectations? You need to eat a fig every day at 2:30 for the rest of your life. This fits into the pattern. And because you can't leave it at 2, 3 being a magic number in these situations, you can stop at 1 or you can stop at 3, but stopping after 2 is totally forbidden. Like this is just not allowed. So he could tell me something like, you must write to the Pope and tell him that he's wrong when it comes to dealing with gay people. 2 of the disciples were gay and 1 was a transvestite, so it's time he changed his mind. I mean, this was in keeping with the current world view. So you can tell quite often, you kind of know whether you're being led up the garden path or whether somebody is, I mean, I'm leading you up the garden path in both stories, but then you can tell whether the story fits into the rubric of mystical experiences or whether it does not. Now, where this gets really interesting was the Hebrew University in Jerusalem got very interested in this mystical experiences. A lot of them were Kabbalists, and the texts were where they started their investigations into mystical experiences. But then modern technology has advanced, so they started studying the brain patterns of people who are having mystical experiences, advanced meditators, rabbis who were known for their holiness and their devotion and their understanding of the world. And they watched what happened in these people's brains when they went from having an ordinary experience where they were drinking tea and chatting about the weather or who's going to get the next academic post or what's happening with climate change. And then when they switched to their religious meditative praying mode and what happened with their brains. And consistently, over time, the same changes happened in people's brains. They could see when people were they could see from their equipment when people were having a mystical experience. Now, what slightly threw them about this was that they were quite happy that they could detect a mystical experience in these people, and these people were religious people, but there was nothing that suggested that there was an external religious presence there. They had no way of detecting whether the angel was there. Elijah more than likely hadn't come. John Henry Newman was not actually talking to the person. So this leads on to the belief that these experiences happen because of the way our brain, the people's brains were wired. A modern day exponent of that, although the Hebrew University of Jerusalem is a modern day institution, but a modern and Western exponent of that is Joe Dispenza. Joe Dispenza talks about people at his workshops, and he wires them up so that they can see how their brain waves change as they do group meditations, and how the energy in the environment changes when you have a group of people whose brain waves synchronize with their heart waves and they're all together in a deep meditative state. He suggests that this creates an environment where people are healed and where the general distress in that particular part of the world is reduced, where people are happier, more content, less anxious. This is where mystical experiences get interesting for me, because I think if these things are going on in our brains anyway, I mean, we're all wired up apparently to have these experiences, they don't have to be experiences that involve seeing John Henry Newman or Our Lady or whatever saint you're interested in. If you go to if you go on the Camino, you don't necessarily see St. James of Compostela, or if you visit other shrines, you don't necessarily see that particular saint. But the effect on our brains can change ourselves and our environment. So if there is a way of making the world a better place by tuning in to this innate mystical ability in all of us, I think it's worth looking into and it's worth doing. The early days transcendental meditators, when they came to Cork, back in the days when Cornelius Luce, he was the Bishop of Cork, he was absolutely horrified, and he couldn't decide whether he disliked transcendental meditators or Moonies more. It was a bit of a toss-up, but they really took the wind out of everybody's sails, because the transcendental meditation people said that as soon as 10% of the population were meditating, there would be a huge change in the psychological environment in the city, that people would be calmer, there'd be less violence, there'd be far less discontent, less anxiety, less drunkenness. Who knows? It never happened, because the population grew suddenly, so 10% became a much higher ask, and the world moved on. People were less interested in any kind of religion, whether it was a conventional Catholicism or transcendental meditation. But there is a kind of a hope that if some number, I can't calculate it and I wouldn't try to, of a population are focused on healing, health, emotional well-being, it can't do the surrounding society any harm, and it may do some good. So feel free to consider the place of mysticism in your life. Consider where you're, whether it has something to offer or whether it does not. Amen.